everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace.
I'm Manny.
This episode, we're going to be talking about DC Rebirth books, plus a couple other books, but all DC in this episode for October 12th, 2016. This last weekend was New York Comic Con, so there surprisingly was very little comic news that came out of New York. I don't ever remember there being less comic news coming out of New York. So that was kind of anticlimactic in a way. We did have a few official announcements, I guess. Specifically, I'm thinking of the Ninjak versus the Valiant Universe announcement from Valiant Comics. Now, most of the information had been leaked already, but we did get some official things and saw a trailer and all that. So there will be an episode specifically dedicated to New York Comic Con coming up. I'm going to release that either on Wednesday the 12th or Thursday the 13th. So look for that if you're curious about some of the goings-on at New York Comic Con. Really the last big show of the year. I know Stan Lee's Kamikaze, well, it's now called Stan Lee's Los Angeles Comic Con. Is that what they changed the name to? Yeah, I think they did.
It's like a long name. It's yeah. Stan Lee's Los Angeles Comic Con.
Yeah, they wanted that Comic Con and Stan Lee in the same, all in the same name. So they're trying to make that a major convention, trying to make it pop culture. It's certainly not there yet. It doesn't rival anywhere near what San Diego or New York is. But so that's the last convention of the year. Except I may go to Tucson Comic Con. We'll see. That's in November. But I have Phoenix Fan Fest coming up the weekend of the 23rd. Which, looking at the guest list this year, last year I interviewed Tim Seeley at the show. Would have liked to have interviewed Dirk Benedict, but this year there's not really anybody that really got me excited. So I'm probably just going to go. I'm not even going to take any of my recording stuff. I'm just going to go purely as fan and not do any podcast stuff, any website stuff. Maybe take a few pictures. That'll be about it. So probably just go Saturday. Then, yeah, the following weekend, that's Halloween weekend, the 28th and 29th. Well, actually, I think it starts on the 27th, Friday. Stan Lee's Los Angeles Comic Con. I think I'm going to go Friday and Saturday. There's a few people at that convention I'd love to talk to, so we'll see how that works out. Bring you as many interviews as I can for that. So, but, yeah, pretty much the big cons are over for the year, so we'll start gearing up for next year. So one bit of Comic-Con news I do want to get your opinion on, Manny. So I'm not sure how accurate this poll is, where they got the numbers, how many people they asked. But according to the statistics that I saw, only 6% of the attendees at New York Comic-Con claimed comics as their primary, like their primary reason for going, like their primary fandom. And it was like 35% video games and you know, other things, TV, movie, all that stuff. But only 6% comics. What do you think about that?
I think it's a real shame. But, I mean, you just said it yourself. There was very little comic news there. And, I mean, that's what's popular. You got YouTube shows, you got movies, you have TV. And as annoying as it might be for you and I, that's just what it is. That's the culture right now that's popular. I mean, there's a lot of these people that watch all the shows, never picked up a comic book, or are hardcore Marvel movie fans, never picked up a comic book. So it is what it is. I mean, how many times have you and I been at a show and somebody says, "Who is that? Who is that signing?" Or who is that over there? I mean, you can have creators walk by many people and they'll never know who they are.
Yeah, I guess it just goes to show, and this is certainly the case at San Diego Comic-Con. One of the panels that I went to this year that was most full, one of the comic panels that was most full, I think it was on Saturday, actually, Saturday afternoon. And it was the DC Meet the Publishers panel, which is always a great panel and usually not very full, you know. It's Dan Didio, Jim Lee sitting up there talking. There's actually some pretty good news. They usually announce some stuff at that panel, and it's usually a really good time. We went there this time, and man, it had never been so full. And Dan Didio was even surprised. He's like, "Oh, you guys are all people here for the panel after whatever." And I was like, "No, we're here for this panel, blah blah, whatever." The panel after that was Animaniacs, fact that that panel was so full was all about Animaniacs was the panel after that. That's just there's just no denying it. I mean, there's plenty of panels that I haven't gotten into at San Diego over the years, and invariably they're TV shows, they're movies, cartoons, anything but comics. There's never been a comic panel that I've wanted to go to that I haven't been able to walk into 10 minutes before, 15 minutes before. Try that with The Walking Dead. Try that with whatever. And what's interesting, because the article that I read that talked about the 6% primary comic fans, what was interesting to them was that the exhibit floor for the entire convention, the exhibit floor, the vendors, the percentage of vendors, especially reflected in the panels. The panels are 6% of the panels are not dedicated to comics. It's way more than that. If 35% of the people picked gaming as their primary interest, and that's why they're at New York Comic Con, 35% of the panels are, it's way less than that that it's dedicated to gaming. So it's a very big disparity. And it just goes to show that the reason New York Comic Con exists is because of the comic part of it. That's why it started. Same thing with San Diego Comic Con. The comics are that, you know, why it started. It might not be why it exists anymore. It might not be the primary reason that it attracts all these people. But it's very interesting to see that, you know, most people aren't going there for comics, but yet there's way more comic panels than there are gaming panels. So I could definitely see New York Comic Con experiencing some growing pains. But I mean, how much bigger can it really get? How much does the gaming industry care? I mean, the gaming industry has plenty of conventions that are dedicated to that. E3 and, you know, all that other stuff. Do they really need to try to take over a comic convention? You know what I'm saying? But of course, these comic conventions, especially the New York Comic Con, which is a for-profit business, unlike San Diego Comic Con, I mean, they're there to make money. They're owned by Reed Pop. Reed Pop's in it to make money. And so if they want to keep attracting these huge numbers, they're going to have to give the people what they want. And if 35% of the people going want gaming panels, they're going to need more gaming panels. So, I don't know. I just find it interesting. Much like you, I find it kind of sad that the reason these things exist, I mean, 6%, man. That's just disheartening to me as a comic fan and a podcaster who thinks there's a comic book out there for everyone. So, I don't know. I'll get off my soapbox, but I just saw that number. I thought I'd ask you what you thought. Yeah, I just think it's sad. It's too bad to see some comics in the hands of some of those people that clearly aren't reading them if it's not their primary interest, because I think maybe they'd like it.
You know? Well, I mean, how many people really read?
That's a whole nother soapbox.
Yeah, I know.
Not about to climb up on. I did see that. I think this was announced at Comic. If not at Comic Con, it was announced right after. And that's there's going to be a Tekken comic coming out, so maybe that can pull in some video game fans.
Please do note, this is no ordinary comic book. It is in permanent condition. If you spill soda on it, the drops fly off harmlessly onto lesser comics.
Oh.
Yes, you are quite correct to gasp.
All right, let's dive into the books for this week. So the first book we're going to talk about is Action Comics, number 965, written by Dan Jurgens. Pencils on this issue are handled by Steven Segovia. The inks are by Art Tabair, and the colors are by Arif Prianto. This is the first part in a new arc. I don't know if you'd call it an arc, I guess. I mean, the last arc, quote-unquote arc, was only two issues. This one may be the same. The last one was Who is Clark Kent? This one is entitled Lois Lane, Back at the Planet, Part 1. So, what'd you think, Manny?
I thought it was interesting because it starts off with Lois Lane, not Lois Lane, and, you know, just trying to get back to the Daily Planet. I was distracted a lot by the artwork. I seem to really enjoy it. But other than that, I didn't really feel too much happen. You know, it's just an introductory issue. And I think this arc may be what I kind of feel like this arc may be one of those that read better in a trade.
All right. I actually was surprised by how much did happen in the issue. It starts out, like Manny said, Lois, who's not Lois. So we know this is the pre-Flashpoint Lois. The Superman from this world died. Apparently, in the pages of Superwoman number 1, the Lois from this version, the new 52 version, also died, which I just find extremely convenient. And I still hope in the pages of that book they bring her back somehow. All along, I was reading Action Comics thinking, okay, we're going to have a Superman. The other Superman's gone, but we're going to have a Clark Kent. How's this Superman who's Clark Kent? Like, how's that going to work? And there's going to be two Loises. How's that going to work? And I don't know, it feels in a way like they took the easy way out by killing her off. So, but supposedly the Lois, the post-Flashpoint Lois, had been communicating with the pre-Flashpoint Lois about writing a Superman book about the, you know, the death of Superman. And now we find out the pre-Flashpoint Lois has been having dreams about the post-Flashpoint Lois. And so she basically, there's a flashpoint in the middle that kind of explains, or a flashback rather, in the middle that kind of explains why she decides to go to the Daily Planet. She's not sure, you know, she's older than this Lois. Is everyone going to accept her as Lois? But I mean, why? In a way, like, why wouldn't they, right? I mean, nobody's going to expect a doppelganger to show up. I certainly wouldn't at my job. But yeah, it's a pretty good story. And between the what goes on at the planet, what goes on at her apartment at the end, which was very interesting, and the flashback in the middle, I thought it did a really good job. And the art by Sokovia is done very well. Really good facial expressions, very good storytelling from panel to panel. One other thing that I'll say about the art is that, like, the cover, it really, like, reminded me of something. I couldn't quite put my hands on it. And then just as we were getting ready to record, I realized what it was. So you remember a few years ago, DC did all the, when they first did the 3D covers, and then they follow, and, you know, they were allocated because it was like new technology. And then the following year, they did them again, but they did them with where the image would change.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yes. But when they did that, but they did the ones with the changing image, all of them had kind of a, like a border around them in a way. And that's what this cover, like, and I think the previous covers too, the Who is Clark Kent covers have that kind of border around it. So that's what it reminded me of. So it just made me, it made me wonder if maybe they were planning on doing that this year too, and then changed their mind or something. Because it just, I don't know. It really looks like one of those covers from a couple years
ago. Well, this one is not necessarily a border. It's just the Daily Planet doors.
Oh, yeah. I did not even realize that. I was thinking it looked more like a border. Well, I guess not so much on the bottom, but with the Rebirth dressing on the top, it makes it look more like it's framing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, she's holding the handles. I didn't even notice that. Yeah. Anyway, it's a great cover, the Clay Mann cover. Great Steven Segovia artwork. Yeah, really digging on Action Comics, but we got limited answers on who is Clark Kent, and that mystery is still there. I know that bothers you.
Yeah, that's you know, it's annoying enough that we have an extra Clark, and now we're moving on to extra Lois or replacement Lois.
Yeah, there you go, replacement Lois. But the thing about replacement Lois, she's kind of like, I mean, it's Lois, so she's going to be investigating what happened to the previous Lois. And just based on the fact that the other Lois is supposedly dead right now, but this replacement Lois is having dreams about her, it's, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It makes me think that...
No, it's definitely interesting.
It gives me, well, it gives me hope that the other Lois is not, maybe not really gone. And that we'll see her return to the pages of Superwoman, because that's really what I would... That's really what I would like the end game to be. Anyway, that's it for Action Comics. It continues to be a great read. Dan Jurgens has a great handle on not just Superman, but his supporting cast too. Because Superman, while he's in this book, he certainly doesn't do anything super heroic. He talks to his wife, and that's about it. And mm-hmm. It's still great. It's still a great read. Like, I loved it. I loved seeing Jimmy Olsen. I loved seeing Perry White. The dynamic between Replacement Lois and Lex Luthor is interesting, because it's been long enough now that the Lex Luthor of the New 52 has been trying to do the right thing that you can't say he's just typical Lex Luthor. And certainly Replacement Lois and Replacement Superman see Lex, they still don't trust him, and neither do I, and neither should any longtime comic reader. But at the same time, this guy's putting his money where his mouth is so far, so I find that very interesting. All right, next up we have All-Star Batman number 3, written by Scott Snyder, pencils by John Romita Jr., inks by Danny Mickey, and colors by Dean White. The backup story, also written by Scott Snyder, art by Declan Shelby, and colors by Jordy Belair. So this is continuing the story of Batman trying to get Two-Face somewhere safe for whatever reason, and we actually find out some of the motivations in this issue. Starts off fighting the Beast, formerly the KG Beast. We see a very brief appearance by the Royal Flush Gang. We see Duke show up and kind of save the day, which was interesting. We see Harold show up. And readers of Batman in the 80s and 90s, very late 80s, or maybe it wasn't until the 90s. Yeah, I think actually it wasn't until the 90s when he showed up. But he eventually betrayed Batman, and I don't know that that was ever fixed. So I wasn't sure about that. I was surprised to see him, but also happy to see him, because I know he was part of the reason that Batman got betrayed at one point. But it was good to see him. So all in all, I enjoyed this issue much more than the previous issue. I didn't like it as much as the first issue, so it's, you know, falls in between there for me. The art, certainly, I mean, the fact of the matter is that I'm not a big John Romita Jr. fan. But based on what I saw in the first issue of All-Star Batman, I had hope. And maybe it was just because he had so much extra lead time on the first issue. Again, it's the art here is better than it was in issue 2, but it's not as good as issue 1. So, I don't know. It'd be interesting to read this as all in one sitting as a trade to see how it turns out. I especially was struck by the way Bruce looks when he doesn't have his cowl on. Doesn't look like a Bruce I've ever seen before. So, yeah, I mean, the story is still interesting. And I love the fact that everybody is showing up. I do kind of wish, I mean, I'm not sure exactly how many issues this is going to be, but I almost wish that every issue was like double-sized, like 48 pages, and it was going to last 12 issues, because the story, the pacing just seems a little choppy to me at times. And I know it's just a fact of Scott Snyder wanting to cram so much in, and just not having the real estate to be able to do so. And of course, I can't possibly imagine how John Romita Jr. would draw 48 pages a month. But maybe that'd be a good thing. You know, it's supposed to be an all-star Batman, right? So maybe get some of these other artists in, rather than doing one arc with this artist, one artist, they just rotate. But then, you know, that sometimes that doesn't work in the trade. It looks choppy, whatever. I don't know. I'm still in on it. I'm still going to read it. I still want to know what happens. But I just think it could be better. And it was better. Like, the first issue was so good, and it just hasn't, I guess maybe it just set the bar too high. The backup story continues to be interesting. The art, I feel, is much better than in the primary story. Backup really focuses on Duke more than anything, and it really seems like he's learning to put two and two together and become a great detective. So I'm enjoying that. The backup very much. And like I said, the art in the backup, Declan Shelby, Jordy Belair, yeah, it's better than the main story for me. How about you, Manny? What are your thoughts?
This is definitely better than the second issue. The pacing is a lot better. And the first few pages of the artwork, just the battles between KG Beast, Batman, and Two-Face, I thought was done really, really well. As good as it's going to get, at least. But then it just gets, as the pages go on, the art just gets worse and worse, to the point where, I mean, the face is just tore up. And it really started to completely take away from the book. I mean, the couple of panels with Black Mask, Penguin, and who's the other person? Whoever the other guy is.
Warren. Is his name? They call him. I don't know who it is, though.
they look flat. And I really disliked it. And then, is Harold supposed to be a hunchback?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, he's all deformed and...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's got all kinds of problems.
All right, so...
That's so you not can maybe give bad. Him a pass on that.
Yeah, you get a pass on
he always looked pretty deformed and weird, so.
I will say, though, that I really like the cover with the semi-truck and KG Beast Batman on the top fighting. Just to see the one eye of Two-Face driving, I don't know, it just, the smoke and, or fire or whatever, it looks, that's actually really, really well done. Batman and KG Beast are actually done pretty well there.
Yeah, I more like the truck than anything. The truck just looks cool.
Yeah.
By the way, the white guy is Great White Shark.
Oh, okay. That's right. The biggest disappointment for me was when I saw the Royal Flush Gang show up, I got really excited. They're some of my favorite gangs, and then it's like...
They don't even last. They last like they're there for like two panels. But I mean, it was kind of funny. Just like, it reminded me of... I love what it says, the Royal Flush Gang, a.k.a. Mess.
Yeah. I was like, ooh, the Royal Flush Gang, and then it's like...
Yeah. It reminded me of this the infamous scene from Indiana Jones where the guy with the knife.
Oh yeah. He just pulls out. I mean, they don't even let the king hit the ground, for Christ's sake. He's still in midair. Yeah. Come on. But I'm in just because I'm very curious to see where this is gonna go. Other than that, I really hate the artwork. And I hate to say that because John Romita Jr. is such a nice guy.
Yeah, I mean, I've said it before, I'll say it again. You know, like, I enjoy his artwork from early in his career. The longer his career's gone on, the more stylized and recognizable as his art it's become. But it just doesn't, I just don't care. It looks too blocky for me. I just don't care for it. All right, next up we have Batgirl and the Birds of Prey number 2, written by Julie Benson and Shauna Benson. Art by Claire Rowe. The flashback art is handled by Roge Antonio, and the colors are by Alan Pasalacqua. So I know you haven't been reading Batgirl and the Birds of Prey. This was a very interesting book. It really, like I said, there's flashbacks in it that Roge Antonio handles the art. The flashback is all about Black Canary and who she was before and, you know, being in the foster system and feeling abandoned by her mother and everything. And so that was probably my favorite part of the issue. And it really, the flashbacks, I feel like it's more real estate and more of a narrative, more of a complete story than the other parts of the issue, which is basically just a couple fights. But again, I just have to go back to being super impressed by the work that Julie Benson and Shauna Benson are doing here. This is their first comic work, Batgirl and the Birds of Prey. This is basically the third issue they've written, the one-shot rebirth issue, and then issue one, issue two. They have such a great handle on who these characters should be, such a great handle on giving it a feeling of sisterhood and of family, and that they even the characters themselves talk about family in this issue. It's just a great. I mean, I'm so impressed by the work these two are doing. It's just absolutely amazing. I feel like if I was a little better versed in all the bat villains and everybody that's going on, maybe I would know who the, like, there's a reveal at the end on the last page and who supposedly kind of the big bad, the one pulling the strings behind the scene is. It's not who our Oracle is yet. We're not to that point. But I feel like maybe if I was a little better versed in the bat universe, maybe in the Birds of Prey universe itself, that corner of the bat universe, maybe I'd know who this is. But they don't name her. He says, "Oh my God, I thought you were dead." The, you know, the mobster they captured, who's being pursued by the Snake Gang, and so clearly he knows who she is. So I didn't know if maybe I was supposed to know who she was or not. But book continues to be very, very good. I definitely recommend it, especially if you're a fan of female strong female characters, because these girls in the Birds of Prey, they're certainly not relying on the help of Batman or any of their male compatriots to help them out. They're kicking butt all on their own. So really, really good job. Next up is Deathstroke, written by Christopher Priest, pencils by Joe Bennett, inks by Mark Morales, and colors by Jeremy Cox. So basically what we have here is Deathstroke has found out that his daughter has a hit put out on her, and the trail leads to Gotham City. So Deathstroke, Slade Wilson, is smart enough to know that it's not Batman himself who put a hit out on her, but yet he knows he's going to have to face Batman if he goes to Gotham City. So it's all about how does he get into Gotham City? How does he, you know, Batman probably knows what's going on there. So it's a matter of getting to Gotham City, knowing he's going to have to go up against Batman. How does he prepare for that? And he does a really good job of preparing for it. There's an incredible scene where Deathstroke is describing just how much planning Batman does before he goes anywhere in his city, sets things up, and it's just it speaks perfectly to who Batman is. I mean, think about Christopher Priest writing a Batman comic. How cool that would be. Well, this is as close as you're going to get. It's a crossover. It's amazing. Everything is set up perfectly. I mean, there's so much depth to the story. I don't want to say too much because I don't want to spoil it, but I'll just say sprinklers. That was cool. And we have next issue, the tease is, you know, Batman versus Deathstroke. So Joe Bennett is not the regular penciler. It's normally Carlo Pagulian, but Bennett does an adequate job. Yeah, the rendering is clean. The storytelling is pretty solid. The panel layouts are good. The page layouts themselves are pretty standard. It's typical comic panels. There's nothing dynamic or special about them. But it's a great job. This is last issue and this issue have really... Christopher Priest, I feel, has really started to hit his stride as far as the pacing goes. The first couple issues are a little dense, kind of hard to get into. But, I mean, I feel like anybody who's a Deathstroke fan who's, you know, just slightly familiar with the character could pick up last issue or pick up this issue and get up to speed and realize what, I mean, you could just pick up this issue and you'd immediately know, like, what's going on. Okay, so Slade Wilson is a villain. He's Deathstroke. His daughter has a hit out on her, and he's going to Gotham to find out who did it and see what he can do to save her. There's also a great interlude kind of in the middle with his daughter Rose talking to Wintergreen, who's kind of Deathstroke's kind of agent, I guess you'd say, you know, books his contracts and all that kind of stuff. And there's a great interplay, interchange between the two of them. And Wintergreen is basically just saying, yeah, this guy is a supervillain. This guy is a psychopath. This guy is not good at showing emotion. He does care about you, but when he calls you an idiot, translation is, wow, you messed up. Let me see how I can help you figure it out. You know, he does a great job of kind of giving us a view into who Deathstroke is. Clearly, he's a bad guy, but at the end of the day, he is still human. He does still care about his children. He might not care about anything else, and he might not be able to express it very well, but it's Christopher Priest using little techniques like this to really show us who Deathstroke is. So really, really great job. Probably my favorite issue of the series so far, just based on the Batman pages. They were just so, so, so cool. Next up, we have Detective Comics number 942, written by Steve Orlando and James Tynan IV. This continues the Night of the Monster Men. I guess this must be the last one, right? I mean, yeah. It seemed like it was the last one. Thank God. Did not care much for this story. We talked about that in the last DC Rebirth episode. I'm not going to get into it again here. You can go listen to that if you're curious why I'm saying that. The art is by Andy McDonald, and the colors are by John Rausch. Kind of anticlimactic in a way here. Well, first let me say the art. The art is done well from a point of pacing and panel layout. The rendering, it's pretty much par for the course, as I've said all along. It suits the story. It suits the monstrous feel of the story well, but it certainly isn't going to win any awards for me as far as rendering goes. It's just not my cup of tea. Very much kind of washed out looking, which I guess suits the rain part of the story. But being that Hugo Strange was this big bad of this story and Monster Men or whatever, and at the end of the day, all it took was Clayface basically sealing him in a room. The guy couldn't hold his breath, and that was it. I mean, it was funny, but it was also very anticlimactic. It was, I don't know. I feel like this story is definitely one that went out with a whimper rather than a bang. I mean, I at least wanted to see, we saw the pages of like Hugo Strange, like pumping iron and getting all buff and everything. At least we were going to see a physical fight between the two. And Batman never even laid a hand on him. So, whatever. Like I said, forgettable story. I'm glad it's over. Glad we can go back to the regular storylines on the Bat books. It does seem like going forward, Detective Comics is going to focus much more on Batwoman and her team rather than Batman. So that's interesting, especially considering at New York Comic Con, an ongoing Batwoman title was announced. So that'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. And you know what I just noticed, which I didn't, because, you know, you see as you're reading, Hugo Strange, he's making these little grunts or whatever, and you're like, what's going on? Like, you know Batman's doing something, but, like, what exactly is it that he's doing? You're not really sure. And then we see the and it gets worse and worse, and then I just read the, I didn't even notice that there was that shot of the building covered with Clayface where you could see his eyes and he's smiling.
Really?
I did not notice that when I read it the first time. I guess I was focused, so focused on the other panel right next to it with Hugo saying, oh, it's hard to breathe. Yeah, I just noticed it right now for the first time that, yeah, oh yeah, there's Clayface covering everything. I didn't realize it was Clayface covering everything until the panel where he's looking in through the window where Batman says, unseal the room, he's unconscious. Damn, you got it. Damn, boss, how long can you go without air? Longer than him. Yeah, pretty funny. So what do you think now that it's all wrapped up? Detective 942, thoughts?
Well, I thought that the confrontation between Hugo Strange and Batman was kind of predictable. Didn't know exactly how he was going to stop him. All I knew was that it was going to be something stupid because because Hugo Strange, as smart as he is, was gonna figure out a way to undermine Batman's strength and you know, his brute force. So when you, like you said, when you see him pumping iron issues before, you just kind of, you're like, you're not gonna fight Batman. He's a ninja.
Batman in a fist so fight.
I don't know. Maybe he just wanted to look good in the costume. I don't know. It's kind of funny. But when he took the air out of him, I thought that was kind of ironic because, you know, all he was doing is talking and talking and talking, and he just took the air out of him and he knocked him out. So that was great. I will tell you the most anticlimactic part of this issue, and maybe it's just because of the announcements and trailers and things that we saw from New York Comic Con. But when the team of the Bat team go into their specific buildings, I really thought they were going to form a giant robot.
Yeah, I kind of thought that too. I was waiting.
Because you see all this, you see everybody inside their pod. Their you see them cockpit. All like yeah. Almost look like motorcycles. The signals line up, and I was like, oh, it's a Bat Family Megazord. And now they're just shooting cannons. So that to me was very anticlimactic. I will say this, Hugo Strange did look really cool though. Sitting on a bunch of books of psychology with the red bat signal behind him and so many images of Batman's brain and how it works, whatever. I thought that was done really, really well because that's a lot of detail to go through. But I mean, this arc, it was what it was, and let's move on.
Yeah, ready to get back to the main stories. All right, next up we have Doom Patrol number 2, written by Gerard Way, art by Nick Darrington, and colors by Tamara Bonvillain. I know you didn't read this one either. I stuck with it, even though the first issue confused the hell out of me. I love the fact that this issue starts out with Larry Traynor, or Negative Man. Really cool cover. We kind of get his origin, and then we see him in current day. He eventually, in the issue, hooks up with a Robot Man, who's been reconstructed. So, still don't know exactly what's going on. Part of the reason I went ahead and read issue 2, even though I was very confused by issue 1, was I talked to a couple of guys at one of the local comic shops here, and they just talked about how much of Gerard Way's books are all about the payoff at the end. So, I decided I would stick it out, and I enjoyed the issue. I'm just still unsure exactly what's going on. So, I guess, you know, we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens next issue. This issue ends in an interesting way. Continues to be entertaining. I'm definitely entertained by it. I definitely want to know what's going on. So I'll stick with Doom Patrol. And I guess we'll see where it goes.
Dude, this book might as well be in Chinese. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's fun, right?
I mean, it's kind of cool, but I would like to know what's going on.
Yeah, maybe you might have to wait for the trade. All right, next up we have Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 6, written by Robert Venditti, pencils by Rafa Sandoval, inks by Jordi Tarragona, and colors by Tomeu More. All right, what'd you think of this?
I'm just really excited to get to the next one. This was really, really good. Just throughout the first couple of pages, I like the fact that it's setting up a big battle, and with so much going on, you got the Green Lantern Corps, you got Hal Jordan fighting the Corps members, and just beating them bad. But obviously Sinestro has something up his sleeve. Real quick, what's up with Sinestro's pants or those pajamas?
Yeah, you like those pajamas? Like Starfield pajamas?
Cosmic pajamas.
Yeah, those are cool. I noticed those right away as well.
All right, it wasn't just me. But anywho, back to it. I really liked about this issue specifically was how much respect Sinestro has for Hal Jordan. And, I mean, we've seen it before time and time again, how even though they're adversaries, at the same time, deep down inside, I've heard Jeff John comment on it that they're really friends to some extent. It's just the fact that they have certain beliefs, obviously Green Lantern, Yellow Lantern, but I mean, his is that a sorceress that's with him?
Lisa, she's not really. She's more like a priestess. She's the keeper of the. There's a book that has like supposedly the entire history of the Yellow Lanterns, both past the entire story of the Yellow Lanterns, both past, present, and future. And so, supposedly, you know, she's seen things and you know whatever.
But yeah, because my favorite line in this book is when he tells her, "It is Hal Jordan. For him, there is no book."
Yeah, because she's always referencing the book in the Sinestro Corps, and there's times when he pretends to go along with what she's saying and what she's predicting. The fact of the matter is, more than any other villain, even more than Darkseid in the DC Universe, Sinestro is a master manipulator, and he mm-hmm. manipulates everyone, and that includes her, who supposedly is the keeper of the lore for all the Yellow Lanterns, and so she's supposed to know everything that he'll do in the future and the consequences and blah, blah, blah. But man, he plays her like a fiddle, just like he tries to do everyone else. And maybe that is why, at the end of the day, it is a friendship with Hal Jordan, because Hal Jordan is like the one person whose behavior he can't necessarily manipulate And because of that, he can't necessarily predict what Hal Jordan is going to do. And he's come to respect Jordan for that, both as an adversary and as a friend. You know, he's like the one, like if you're able to manipulate everybody around you, you can't help but have contempt for the people around you because you feel they're weak if you're able to control them in a way. And so mm-hmm. how can you ever, you know, it's hard to be friends with people that you feel are beneath you. And he can only be friends with somebody who's an equal to him, and Hal Jordan may be the only one.
Yeah, and then, I mean, and he proceeds, the amount of respect he has for him, he proceeds to supercharge himself to 700.
Oh, 1,000.
No, he gets 1,000.
I knew it was going to be 1,000. 10 times, his ring is charged up 10 times as much as normal.
Yeah, so I mean, he doesn't even go outside until he supercharged himself to 1,000%, which tells me, you know, how much he respects or even fears willpower, and specifically Hal Jordan's willpower. So the next issue is going to be real interesting to see how Hal Jordan's self-made ring faces off against, you know, the supercharged Yellow Ring and Sinestro's fear. But also we have a couple of wild cards in the fact that we still have Guy Gardner being Guy Gardner even as he's being tortured, and at the same time the Green Lantern Corps gets closer and closer to showing up as well. So it's setting up to be Maybe, you know, that issue that we've been waiting for, the Green Lanterns taking back the duties by force of patrolling the Thestral coming down. I thought was really done really, really well.
You cut out right there. What'd you say?
And the last panel, Thestral descending down.
Oh, yeah,
that it was done really, really well.
When he's got the 1,000K armor on.
Yeah, and the cape, armor and it just looks, I mean, his ring is just blazing, so.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, even his word balloons, leave us, all of you, I will deal with Hal Jordan. So I have a few thoughts about this issue, actually. I loved it. It was absolutely amazing. This is going to read great in a trade.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I love the way it reads as single issues because the different story beats are so, they're so much more evident. And I think as you read it in a trade, it'll make for a great story, but you maybe won't be as aware of what a masterful job Venditti is doing with the story as far as ratcheting up the tension and the suspense. Two issues ago, it was like this all-out action, super cool, really great, a lot of battles, awesome issue. And then last issue, it kind of slowed down a little bit. We got some great character moments with Hal and Saranik, and it seemed like it was ratcheting up. And then this issue, it ratchets up a little more. We get the great scenes with Hal. Fighter pilot, hello. So, of course, he's going to attack the Yellow Lanterns in fighter jets. It's, in a way, this issue is a lot of setup. Watching the tension build, you see the numbers ticking up on Sinestro. He has his Yellow Lantern priestess or priest guy. What are they called? Administrator or whatever? Go tell him to basically supercharge everybody. Mm-hmm. And I knew it was going to go up to 1,000. You just knew that was going to be the number. But what's interesting is that we've seen in the past, actually we saw it start in the last series, that Hal Jordan is starting to become willpower itself. So you wonder if maybe he can, even though he's not supercharged, if maybe he's going to be able to match this 1,000% that Sinestro has, because he's going to, I mean, his whole body can become will. And so I imagine we're going to see that manifest in this big battle that's coming up. I mean, how can it not? Hal Jordan, in order to fight a Sinestro that's has a ring that's 10 times more powerful than normal, he's going to have to do something out of the ordinary. So, and it wouldn't surprise me if that ends up being the reason that Hal is able to emerge victorious, because at the end of the day, it's Sinestro being charged up by this fear engine that he has this administrator create and fill up with fear. But he's still dependent on something from outside himself. Whereas when you look at Hal, he's wearing a ring that he himself forged, and he's basically like his own battery, his own, like, if he has the willpower to believe he can beat Sinestro, then I gotta believe he'll beat Sinestro. So again, I just think it's a masterful job by Venditti telling the story. I've heard a few people, when Venditti took over from Geoff Johns, I mean, Geoff Johns, rightfully so, is hailed as one of the greatest Green Lantern writers of all time. He brought in the entire color spectrum. He brought in all these great ideas, added so much to the mythos of the Green Lanterns. And so all the kudos are well deserved, but so many people, they're like, oh, Venditti took over, he ruined Green Lantern, I can't read it anymore, blah, 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 blah. Man, from the time he took over the book, I've loved everything he's done, much in the way that Geoff Johns has managed to add to the mythos. Venditti has managed to tell nothing but original ideas and original stories, which isn't necessarily easy to do with a character that's been around as long as Green Lantern. Hal Jordan's been around since the beginnings of the Silver Age. And so to be telling these new stories, constantly challenging Hal, and Venditti's a writer who will tell you that he focuses on the long term. So for him to constantly be challenging Hal and by challenging him, showing how much of a hero he is, that he's been able to overcome all these different things that Venditti's thrown at him, because he's really put the Green Lantern Corps and Hal Jordan himself through the ringer. And so for me, I love Jeff Johns as a Green Lantern writer. He's probably my favorite Green Lantern writer. But you know what? Venditti's right up there with him, man. They're neck and neck. I love what both of them have done. I love just – he's just masterfully been building to these moments. Like all the big arcs that I've read that he's done. And this, that's what this issue really made me realize, is just how masterfully he's telling these stories, and he's using the story beats to keep you interested and keep you engaged. It's just, it's a master class in storytelling to keep the reader engaged, to build to something big. And man, he just, I feel like this guy was born to write Green Lantern. He's amazing. So kudos to Venditti. Kudos to the art team. Rafael Sandoval has done an incredible job. Yeah, I'm loving this book. This issue for me really elevated Hal Jordan, the Green Lantern Corps, way up the list. For me, it's probably up there with Wonder Woman and Green Arrow at this point, ahead of the Superman books, as much as that pains me to say, because I love Superman. But I think this is right up there in the top three right now. It's so, so, so good.
Now, let me ask you something. I've kind of noticed between all the Lantern books, including the other book with Green Jessica and Simon Bass, do you kind of feel like there's a Spectrum event coming soon? Because I kind of feel that they're really messing with the emotional spectrum in very unnatural ways, all of them. For example, you have the Red Lanterns who are trying to manipulate Earth through the Red Dawn, and then you have Hal Jordan making his own ring, in a sense, like you were saying, becoming willpower himself. You have Sinestro capturing an entity to kind of suck out all the fear out of it, and that way he can supercharge himself. So he can make Warworld so much more powerful. And then you still have, like, that other Guardian who created the Phantom Ring, which can be wielded by anyone. So I kind of feel that the state of the emotional spectrum in that universe, in the DC universe, might be very, very fragile. And I can't see it go on that much longer without any consequences.
Well, I don't know. I mean, at the end of the day, it's all sales driven, right? And so, I mean, when Johns introduced the different spectrums, all the different cores and rings, whatever, and then eventually it led into Blackest Night, which was a giant event. I don't see an event like that on the horizon, really, because unfortunately, I don't think the Lantern books are to the level as sales-wise that they were back then. Venditti writes for the long term, and we've certainly seen things that he's done, especially when Van Jensen was writing New Guardians. We don't know where Kyle Rayner over in Omega Men, White Lantern, that whole thing, Relic, holdover from the previous universe that basically died out because this reservoir of power that keeps the universe going was exhausted, because that's where the Lanterns draw their power from, which of course led into the Green Lantern Oblivion, Green Arrow Lost Army. So we have all that going on. We haven't seen a lot of the other cores. You know, we've seen the Red Lanterns in the Green Lanterns book. We've seen the Yellow Lanterns here, and then of course Green Lanterns in both. But we haven't seen a Larfleeze, the Orange Lantern, in a long time. We haven't seen the Violet Lanterns for a long time. We haven't seen the Indigo Lanterns. We saw Black Hand from the Black Lanterns, but he was apparently defeated in the final issues of the previous Green Lantern series. Haven't seen any White Lanterns other than Kyle Rayner in a long time. And he's off with Omega Men right now doing God knows what. We know the Blue Lanterns are going to be returning in the pages of Hal Jordan and the Green Lanterns coming up in a few months. So I suppose there could be something long-term planned. I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't all hammered out at this point. But I don't necessarily see a long not necessarily a long-term plan, but I don't necessarily see a big event that would be like a line-wide thing, like Blackest Night was, that you know, would cross over to all the DC books. It certainly could be that eventually down the line we'll see something happen between the two Lantern books. When I talked to Robert Venditti and Sam Humphries when Rebirth, all the details were announced at WonderCon, they talked about the fact that they don't have anything planned long-term at that point, but anything could happen because they're Lantern books. So I would be surprised if we see it any earlier than about a year from now. I think they're still just telling their own stories at this point. But, I mean, I would love it. But like I said, I think, unfortunately, the sales numbers aren't necessarily there at this point. But I guess we'll see. All right, next up we have The Lost Boys, number one, written by Tim Seeley, art by Scott Godlewski, Godlewski, and colors by Tris Mulvihill, Mulvihill. So this is basically a sequel to the Lost Boys movie, which was a pretty big cult hit in the late 80s with, who was in it, Jason Patrick and Corey Haim and Corey Feldman. It's a really fun movie. If you haven't seen it, Kiefer Sutherland plays the main bad guy. So anyway, this is like basically the takes place a few weeks after the end of that movie. It was entertaining. Probably if you've never seen the movie or not a big fan of the movie, you'd probably just be kind of like whatever. But it was interesting enough that I'll probably read the next issue. The art was average, I'd say. Nothing super great. The colors were by Trish Mulvihill, I thought, were actually done pretty well. Captured the mood. That was much better than the rendering of the art itself. And Tim Seeley, you can tell he's a fan of the movie. So it was cool to see a lot of the characters in the movie show back up. And I'll definitely read the second issue to see what goes on. It was interesting enough. Next up, we have New Superman number 4, written by Jean Luen Yang, pencils by Victor Bogdanovic, inks by Richard Fran, and colors by Hi-Fi Design. This is New Superman is becoming a book that's exactly what I expected it to be, and that's a real study in character growth for the main character, Kenan Kong, who started out as kind of a bully and very unlikable, and we're really starting to see him grow as a character as he tries to live up to the mantle of Superman. So this issue really continued that trend. The last page was really, really cool. I don't want to spoil it for anybody who reads New Superman and hasn't had a chance to read it, but it definitely complicates the story immensely, and I can't wait to see where it goes next. And for fans of Greg Capullo, if you aren't reading this book, you definitely need to, because the pencils by Victor Bogdanovic remind me so much of Capullo, especially with the art of Richard Friend, who's an incredible inker and a great artist in his own right. And the colors by Hi-Fi Design, they really tend to have more of a primary palette, which suits the book very well, because like Capullo, Bogdanovic's style's a little cartoony, a little stylized, but this has a little bit of a Silver Age feel as well, and so those primary colors suit the book very well. But yeah, really, really great book. You can tell Jean Yang starting to hit his stride, and you can tell he's really having fun with these characters, writing about the Justice League of China. So really, really fun book. Next up, we have Red Hood and the Outlaws, number 3, written by Scott Lobdell, art by Dexter Soy, and colors by Veronica Gandini. I'm going to talk about the colors first. Veronica Gandini on color, she's been very consistent. The book has had the same tone and mood throughout, and I feel like that's very much to do with the color palette she's chosen and how consistently she colors the book. And Dexter Soy has also drawn every issue, and that helps with the consistency as well. And his art is absolutely beautiful. I could see this guy becoming a real superstar, and I could see some of these early Red Hood and the Outlaws issues being sought after, because I don't know that the sales are necessarily real high, but I could definitely see people seeking them out just because of his art. Scott Lobdell continues to have an incredible take and handle on who exactly Jason Todd is, so I really appreciate the consistency. This book certainly has much less of a humorous tone than Red Hood and Arsenal did, and even less than Red Hood and the Outlaws when the title that launched with the New 52 did. That being said, he does get his lines and laughs in there when he can, and I'm really looking forward to seeing where he takes this team. The Outlaws haven't come together yet. We've seen Red Hood and Artemis fight side by side. This issue really is more focused on Bizarro, And we see at the end that he's really starting to establish an identity. And I think the next issue, by the end of the next issue, we'll have the three together. We'll have Red Hood, Artemis, and Bizarro together, working towards a common goal, kind of a band of misfits thrown together, I have a feeling. But I'm really enjoying this book. I said that the Rebirth issue, Red Hood and the Outlaws, was the best thing Scott Lobdell has written that I've ever read, and I stand by that. But I also feel like this whole series has much more depth than anything that I've ever read from Scott Lobdell. I mean, I've enjoyed his writing in the past, traditional comic book writing and enjoyable stories, but there's layers to this that I've never noticed before in his writing. I'm not saying they haven't been there, but there's layers to his writing in this that go beyond anything I've read from him before. So kudos to him. Kudos to Dexter Soy on the art. Really, really, really outstanding. All right, next up we have Suicide Squad number 4, written by Rob Williams, pencils by Jim Lee, inks by Scott Williams, Sandra Hope, Jonathan Glapion, and Trevor Scott, and colors by Alex Sinclair and Hi-Fi Design. And the backup, the art is handled by Gary Frank, and the colors are by Brad Anderson. Again, I'm sounding like a broken record here. It's just hard. So hard to get into these Suicide Squad stories because they're so short. But they did have a good wrap-up to the issue. There was a lot of good character moments. The new character that's been introduced to the team, Hack, certainly seems like she could definitely be somebody who's, you know, really powerful and a very important part of the team, I'll say. And there certainly are a lot of plot threads and things that are introduced that have been introduced in this first arc that we can see play out long term. This is issue 4, but because of the shortness of the stories, I feel like I've only read about 2 issues, and I feel like I need to go back and read issues 1 through 4, just the primary stories, over again to get kind of a better feel of is this story really worth reading? I mean, it's Rob Williams, so I feel like it will be. The art on this issue, you know, it's Jim Lee, who still is a master, like I talked about last issue, but the art really did suffer a little bit from having so many inkers on this issue. It just felt a little inconsistent. The colors by Alex Sinclair, you know, those are always good. And all I'm going to say about the backup is it's probably the weakest backup that I've read so far. The art by Gary Frank is outstanding. Love Gary Frank art. Absolutely incredible. But the reason why the two characters that go on the mission, I completely understood that, and I thought it was going to make for a great story. And then I just didn't see why. I mean, it didn't feel like it accomplished anything. I mean, supposedly it did, but I didn't see it. You know what I'm saying, Manny? Like, so Harley Quinn and Rick Flagg go on this mission, and it's basically to see if Flagg can trust Harley Quinn, and the mission goes down. And at the end, we're kind of led to believe that Flagg trusts Harley, but I didn't see any reason why he should, necessarily.
I thought it was all set up for a minute or something.
Yeah, it just, whatever. It was like I said, it was by far the weakest backup so far, but maybe the best art. The art's absolutely gorgeous. Love Gary mm-hmm. Frank art. So, what'd you think about Suicide Squad number 4?
You know, to be honest with you, the only really good bright spot I saw in this issue was Hack, and I look forward to seeing her in future Suicide Squad arcs, just because it looks like she's quite a bit of a fan of Harley Quinn.
Yeah.
So I wonder how that's going to play out later. Is Harley going to manipulate her to do certain things or to sway a certain way? So that has me really interested. Plus, she seems to be, of course, really smart and have a lot of really good tech abilities. So that was really cool. Other than that, I found the issue kind of to be a waste of time, just because a lot of the fighting and whatnot of them trying to escape that underwater prison, it had already been done the issue before. I mean, Zod's still pretty much doing the same thing. Just throwing people around, and then Katana Sword is what gets it done. I had already seen it the issue before, and then this like Russian version of the Suicide Squad, as they call it, I don't know, I just found it unnecessary. You have the same banter between Amanda and somebody else back at HQ, telling her that she's crazy, obviously. So, you know, it's because they have Jim Lee on this book, I just think it was a waste. You could have used it to do a little bit more than just the old school Suicide Squad story. I just thought they could have done a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, it was supposed to be Jim Lee and Philip Tan working together, and that's how they were going to stay on track. And then they change their mind and do these backups, and it's just like, it's not for me. It's not working. I mean, the backups are entertaining. Don't get me wrong, but I need more. I need more from the main book in order to keep reading, in order to care. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's the only reason I'm really sticking to this one is because of this chapter, I guess, this arc is pretty much over. So I'm interested to see what they're going to do coming ahead. But then again, we know what's coming ahead. We have Justice League versus Suicide Squad coming soon. So I want to see how that gets set up. But at the same time, between last issue and this issue, it could have just been one. You didn't need two issues for it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We've read four issues so far, but really we've only read two. And not even two. I mean, two issues, but two Jim Lee drawn issues, which we all know that Jim Lee drawn issues you read really, really fast. So maybe actually an issue and a half worth of actual content, which is not much when, you know, four issues have come out. So, all right. Well, Supergirl number 2 is up next, written by Steve Orlando, art by Brian Ching, and colors by Mike Adia. In stark contrast to Suicide Squad number 4, there's a lot in this issue. A lot of depth, a lot of story. Now, I said I was out on Supergirl because it was too much of just a playoff of what's in the TV show. But I actually feel like this issue captured the things that were best about the show. So we basically see Kara Danvers get a job at CatCo. We see that there's going to be some tension between her and some of her coworkers. We learn that, or as she finds out herself, that Cyborg Superman, who we saw at the end of last issue, is really her father. We get some of his backstory. And I don't know. For me, this was a really, really strong issue. By far the strongest issue of Supergirl so far. I still don't know that I'm necessarily going to be in on it. But this was a very quality issue. Really showed the strength of Steve Orlando as a writer, and how he's managing to kind of tie these disparate threads of Supergirl together. My biggest problem with it is still the same problem I had from the beginning of this iteration of Supergirl. It's just, she clearly was so much older right from the start when she landed on Earth at her series launch with the New 52. And so this dialing back of age and everything is just, it's hard for me to reconcile it with my brain. I liked that version of Supergirl more. But like I said in the past, those clearly that wasn't resonating because the sales numbers just weren't there for that book. So maybe with this showing so many, similarities with the TV show, will do better. So if that's the case, I'm fine with that. But Steve Orlando's got some interesting ideas, and I'm interested enough, I'll probably at least flip to the next issue to see where it goes from here. What did you think?
Supergirl is quickly rising as one of my favorite books. I really enjoyed it. I like the first, this arc, how they're really playing on one of her biggest issues, which is missing Krypton and missing her family. So Cyborg comes out and pretty much claims that he's her father, and you can tell that she's having trouble with it. No, you're not my father, but you can kind of tell panel by panel that maybe there's a part of her that kind of wishes it were true. Just because, I mean, she really misses her family, and I'm sure she wants a piece of it back, and it's setting up to be quite a trap, I guess. So I am very interested to see where this goes ahead, and then also the way she interacts with Cat Grant, you distinctly see the difference between Supergirl and then Kara. So I thought it done really well, and looking at this in parallel with the show that was just started up again on Monday, I thought that it had a lot more similarities to what they're doing now also. So even though the age difference is, like you mentioned, it's a little bit different, because even in the TV show she's a lot older. I like it, and I think it works. And I'm still really, really digging the art. So, I'm definitely in on Supergirl.
All right, up next we have Superwoman, number 3, written by Phil Jimenez. Pencils in this issue were by Emmanuel Lupacchino, inks by Ray McCarthy, and colors by Hi-Fi. So the first thing I noticed was that it wasn't Phil Jimenez on pencils, but Emmanuel Lupacchino's art. She's a great artist. I've always liked her work from when I first saw her come over to American Comics on some Valiant titles. So the art is done very well. She especially handles her storytelling and her panel layouts very well. The story itself, very much focused on Lex Luthor. I feel like I'm getting a little too much Lex in the Superman books right now. I really miss Lois. There wasn't necessarily anything in this story that made me think that we'll see Lois come back. I'm not a huge fan of Lana Lang. I did find that this new Ultra Woman could be very interesting. And we see that time could be running out for Lana sooner than she expects. So I'm still in on Superwoman. There's enough going on and enough mystery that I'm still in. Trying to wash the bad taste out of my mouth about Lois being gone from the book, still hoping that we're going to see her return. So it's still a solid book. So yeah, I'm still in on Superwoman. This was a good, solid issue. Next up, we have The Flash number 8, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Carmine DiGiandomenico, and colors by Ivan Placencia. This is basically the end of the first arc. We see Godspeed is defeated. We see Wally West become Kid Flash, and we know he's going to meet the previous Wally West, who was the previous Kid Flash next issue. I don't want to say it was anticlimactic. Everything made sense. But I don't know. To me, it felt a little bit like Godspeed was defeated just a little bit too easily. But there's still a lot of threads from this first arc, a lot of ideas that were introduced that are still in play. And we see that at the end when Barry has a conversation with August. So a lot to explore, a lot of stories still to tell for Joshua Williamson. So I have a feeling that reading the whole arc in one sitting will make for a good story. But I don't know how satisfying the ending's going to be. I think it may be that this run on a Flash by Joshua Williamson is going to be one of those where you have to read the whole omnibus or the whole giant, you know, however long his run is, 20 issues or 25 issues. It may be that we, looking back years from now, will be, okay, you have to read, just like when people look back at the Geoff Johns era of the Flash, you need to read the whole thing in order to get the most out of it. And that seems to be the path that Joshua Williamson is taking, so. The art, Carmine DiGiandomenico, it's not my favorite art. Colors by Ivan Placencia are good, not great. But the art, yeah, it's just not my favorite. The rendering just doesn't do it for me. So, but all in all, a good issue. I like what Williamson has done so far.
I find a lot of the Flash books are anticlimactic at the end when he defeats Zoom, or in this case, Godspeed. It seems fairly similar one to another when at the end. But I do always like the journey that he takes to getting to the moment where he defeats the villains. In this case, same thing. I like the story getting to Godspeed. Although it was a little bit predictable in the beginning, I would want to see what comes next from this, because Godspeed was a great concept, and it's kind of Barry gone wrong. And so I liked it. I thought it was done well, and you know, it leaves a nice little cliffhanger at the end. With the reintroduction of Kid Flash, I thought was done really well. And unlike you, I love the artwork. I started not liking it in the beginning, and issue by issue, I liked it more. And this issue was definitely, for me, the best one. Some of the best images are best panels were the first two page spread with Godspeed really in your face, and then Barry chasing him in the back, and then also when Wally gets his costume and he's really just, he has his foot on Godspeed. I love that that panel. I think that would be a great print to have. Yeah, definitely good. Flash is always having moral issues, and so I would like to see if, you know, is he really gonna continue to allow himself to have a team with him, or does he revert back to this is my job and I gotta do it on my own, I don't want to put anybody else in danger. Overall though, very, very good.
All right, the last book we're going to talk about, Wonder Woman number 8, written by Greg Rucka, art by, I'm guessing on this, but I think it's Bilquis, yeah, I think it's Bilquis Evely, and colors by Romula Fajardo Jr. So this originally was supposed to be Wonder Woman year 1 issue, with art by Nicola Scott, but we know that the creative team, for whatever reason, decided to give some backstory on Barbara Ann Minerva, who is Cheetah. And we've also seen that because of that, Nicola Scott is actually staying on until issue 14 of Wonder Woman rather than 12, so she's still going to be doing 6 issues to tell her year 1 story. So I really enjoyed this issue. I really enjoyed the backstory it gave, but I felt like it was incomplete. I guess I just expected... I mean, the story easily could start out the same way it did and follow the same flow, same narrative, but it doesn't... This story doesn't end with Barbara Ann Minerva becoming the Cheetah. There's still more story to tell. So in that, I was a little surprised. It's still done incredibly well. It definitely gives some insight into why the Cheetah is the way she is. Incredible story and character development by Greg Rucka. The art, if I'm honest, I didn't enjoy this art as much as I enjoy Nicola Scott's art. So knowing that Bilquis Evely is going to be the artist that replaces Nicola Scott on Wonder Woman saddens me, you know, but I know that Nicola wants to get back to her work on her creative own Black Magic title, which is certainly understandable. But, you know, for me, Nicola is one of my favorite artists in all of comics and one of my favorite people in the world, let alone comic creators. So, you know, I don't falter that at all. And I hope in the meantime, you know, because it's still a few months away before Bilquis comes on the book, that, you know, she probably can improve. She's a relatively new artist, hasn't been working in the industry for a long time. So there's certainly room for improvement there. And her storytelling is great. Her panel layouts could use some work, and her rendering for me is just a little stiff. So those are all areas where she could easily improve. And I know that the other members of the creative team and Nicola herself have all been singing her praises. So I trust them more so than I trust my own ability to judge talent, being that they're in the industry. So if they have faith in her, I have to feel that faith is well-founded. So, yeah, good issue of Wonder Woman. Cheetah, this version of Cheetah is very complex, very much depth of character, and I'm really glad I got that Liam Sharp cheetah sketch at San Diego this year. What were your thoughts on Wonder Woman, Manny?
First of all, I think it's really unfair to you to judge somebody else's artwork up to Nicola Scott, because we both know how great her artwork is.
Well, that's true.
And it's hard to really, you know, match that level of artistic.
Yeah, you're right.
That's pretty much the dream team. We got the dream team for the first few issues of Greg Rucka and Nicola Scott, and then also Liam Sharp, vice versa. So, no matter who they got, it was no offense to any, you know, to the artist, but it was going to be a little bit of a step down, just because, I mean, if you go back and listen to any of our other podcasts where we're covering any of the other Wonder Woman books, you just know how big of a fans we are of their artistic style, that sometimes we've both mentioned that it doesn't even need words to really tell a story. So going ahead, I mean, we'll see how it goes. With that being said, onto the book. I thought it was really well done. I thought that this was going to be like a two-parter or something like that to tell Cheetah's story. So when I got to the end of it, I wasn't really disappointed, because I thought there was more to it. But now that you're saying that this was it, I'm kind of
disappointed. Yeah, I think, I mean, because doesn't it say that next, I mean, it says what the next issues are.
Yeah, the Lies Part 5. Year one, part four. I mean, do you think maybe that the year part four kind of intertwines with Cheetah's origin? Because I'm sure that you know, they have to meet and intertwine.
Yeah, I mean,
in order for her to become Cheetah,
it could be.
But I mean, this issue happens before she meets. Steve Trevor, right? Or am I wrong?
Well, we have no idea really where in Wonder Woman's story this takes place.
Well, I trust Greg Rucka, so I guess we'll have to wait and see in the next couple of issues, see where they go. But I thought it was done pretty well, and I just need a little bit more on her background. And I mean, interesting enough that, you know, it's a Wonder Woman book, and that you just take one of her villains, her main villain or adversary, and it's really good. So it tells you the level of Grant Brooker's great storytelling.
All right, so what's your book of the week?
Without a doubt, Hal Jordan and the Green Lanterns Corps.
Wow, really? For the first time, same choice. For the first time ever, yes. Without question, hands down, it's not even close. Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, number 6, book of the week. Amazing job. Absolutely amazing job by all the creative team. Book was awesome. It just really stood out among the crowd. So I guess that's going to do it. Usually we have little longer on the book of the week because we're trying to convince each other that we're right, but
well, actually lately the problem we've had is we just wanted to make sure we got different books on, because we have our two or three that were really, really close, but this week it's not even close.
Yeah, I agree. Once again, I'd like to thank everyone for joining us. Please visit us at thecomicsourceblog.com for all past episodes of the podcast. You can also watch episodes of our YouTube channel there, as well as finding links to Manny's written blog and my written blog, and of course our infamous sketch gallery. If you're following us on Twitter, it's twitter.com/thecomicsource. Also do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram. Keep up to date on all new episodes and convention coverage. We really appreciate all the support. Every download we get helps us have more access to creators, attend more conventions, maybe even get some exclusives for you down the line. So we appreciate you listening. Reach out to us on Twitter and let us know what your book of the week was, what you're reading, if there's something you want us to review, something you think we're missing out on. We'd love to hear from you guys. So thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.